You see, I have labeled this part here Lutherans in the American Melting Pot. I suppose it wouldn't hurt to say a little bit something about the previous material here, because a whole week has elapsed and I didn't really have very much time to do full justice to the last major subdivision there. But I'm going to pick that part up once more. If you have outline number 2 in front of you on the obverse page there, capital B on the bottom third of the page, the Americanization of Lutheranism and the Young Republic, I will touch on once more to develop that more fully. And also the Roman, or rather Arabic 2 part there, I'll pick that up. But to summarize in general what we had taken up, I had outlined the planting of Lutheranism in colonial America, and I had mentioned Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, one of the most outstanding of the Lutheran pastors who worked in America several decades before the outbreak of the Revolution, and who in the time of the American Revolution then had a severe problem to solve, because he had a high level of respect for the injunction that St. Paul gives to be obedient to government that has rule over you. And besides that, I had pointed out that Muhlenberg himself was from the province of Hanover in Germany, as were also the kings called the Georges in England. You have not my hand. And so I had outlined for you the difficulty that Muhlenberg himself had, and I also pointed out that the second generation of Lutheran pastors, as exemplified in his sons, already had a much easier time, and they adjusted much more readily to the idea of a revolution which would break away from the sovereignty of the British Empire and establish an independent country. Now, as I was checking through some materials, I read one historian here just the other day who affirmed that unlike the Anglicans, who were really attached to the church in England and were directly under the Archbishop of Canterbury and so on, with the English kings head of the church, unlike the Anglicans, the Lutherans, he said, didn't have that kind of affiliation with any European church or state, and therefore Lutherans had a much easier time easing into the period of the Revolution, staying loyal to the American side rather than the English side, and so made their way easily into the new independence period after 1776. But that's not telling the whole story. There were quite a number of Lutherans who felt constrained to leave the colonies and go to Canada when the Revolution broke out. So there were some goodly number of tensions, by the way, on this issue of whether it was justifiable to rise in violent revolt against the constituted authority. But by and large, the Americans survived that period easily enough in the final end, because Great Britain was defeated, or at least if it was not just mauled, they decided that it wasn't worthwhile fighting for the colonies. And that's how the American government was established. And so, of course, the revolutionaries didn't have any retribution worked out on them. If they had lost, it would have been a much different situation, I dare say. But anyway, when we look at the Lutherans in early 19th century America, then we're already a couple of decades beyond the time of the American Revolution, and we see some interesting developments there. Now, one of the first subtopics that I have highlighted there under this first major caption is the expansion of the Lutheran population on the Atlantic seaboard. So we have to keep in mind that the part of North America which gained independence from Great Britain was the 13 colonies, and they were all along the Atlantic seaboard. See, America hadn't even expanded to the Mississippi at that time. But this is precisely the kind of movement that begins. I suppose I could have turned parts A and B around and given you part B first. But I'd like to keep the emphasis on the churches, so I will take this expansion of the church, the Lutheran church, first. And under small a, I have some additional information on further Lutheran synodical expansion. The organization of the New York Ministerium is of some significance. Some Pennsylvania ministerium pastors continued to work in New York, which was quite a distance when you had to travel by stagecoach or on horseback. And therefore, those New York ministerium pastors, Pennsylvania ministerium pastors who worked northeast from there in New York, eventually thought of the possibility of organizing their own ministerial association. And this man, Pastor John Christopher Kunze, who was a son-in-law of Henry Melchior Muhlenberg and was pastor of Trinity and Christ congregations in New York, was the leading individual in this movement. He tried several times to get some of the pastors together, and in 1792, they had a formation of an association which gradually grew into the New York Ministerium. And by the way, I should mention once more, the very name New York Ministerium indicates that it was not a synod such as we are accustomed to seeing in our own Missouri Synod structure, where congregations and the laymen who are members of these congregations take full part. But it was really an association of clergy, of pastors. Now, I mentioned in connection with the Pennsylvania Ministerium, which was organized in 1748, you remember, that gradually laymen petitioned the pastors for admission to these conventions. So gradually a change occurs in these Eastern synods also. Another organization which was established at one time in South Carolina had a Latin name, and that was called the Unio Ecclesiastica. It's also the Church Union. And this consisted of seven Lutheran and Reformed pastors who met to form a ministerial society in 1787. So that was pretty early, too. And the significant and interesting thing in this development, it's really not all that important, but I listed here as one of the rather unusual developments, at least for a Missouri Synod Lutheran, a strange kind of combination, that there were Lutheran and Reformed pastors in the same kind of an association. This collapsed afterwards. It wasn't big enough, and I don't think it had enough cohesiveness to survive very long. And then point number C, the Ohio Synod, founded in 1818. This will become a very important segment in our concerns later on. You see, when I take up capital B later on, you will see how this all came about. Because Lutherans were moving westward here, especially from Pennsylvania, down further here from Virginia and the Carolinas, they moved into Tennessee and Kentucky. But when Lutheran settlements sprang up along the eastern part of Ohio, it was necessary to send some pastors and missionaries after them to organize them into congregations, and that is how the Ohio Synod was organized, by pastors who had come out of the Pennsylvania ministerium and began serving these congregations in Ohio. Later on, we'll pay some more attention to the Ohio Synod, by the way. We meet that a number of times in the its relationships with the Missouri Synod later on. But while we're talking about the nature of synodical organization, by the way, and usually we call that church polity. I'm sure I got the word. I think I have it in there afterwards. But church polity is the kind of organizing rationale that is built into an organization. I'd like to say in this connection that the early Ohio Synod was structured like a bicameral government, that it had two houses, like our Congress, the Senate and the House of Representatives, comprising two separate echelons or layers. And in this Lutheran Synod, we find the same thing for a while after its organization. Later on, they changed this. But this, the upper house then consisted of the clergy, and the lower house consisted of the laity. I wouldn't be surprised but that there may have been a few pastors in that early Ohio Synod who would participate in the, or at least they would think they participated in the real discussion of real church work in the upper house, while the laymen were permitted to play at something or other in the lower house. Then another interesting development was under small d, the Evangelical Lutheran Tennessee Synod, which you note by the date, 1820, is also founded fairly early. And significant and important in this were the Henkels. There was Paul Henkel, a Lutheran pastor, and six sons who were pastors, and one or two of them also very influential, by the way. And the Henkels, by and large, were inclined to more conservative Lutheranism than was prevalent in those eastern states at that time. And one of the interesting tensions that developed in the early years here, right there where the synod was organized, was with a pastor by the name of Gottlieb Schober, who was a former Moravian and therefore had a less a Lutheran consciousness than the Henkels had. So there were some tensions on this issue. Another synod that was founded fairly early is the Evangelical Lutheran Synod of Indiana, founded in 1835. And this particular synod I list as the books on the history of Lutheran churches generally describe them. It was an anti-generalist synod. Now, this meant that it was against the theology of the General Synod, which was organized in 1820, and that was the first federation of Lutheran synods, by the way. The first federation of Lutheran synods was the General Synod, and it had a theology which was a little bit laxer than people like the Henkels preferred. And so here we have another group in Indiana on the frontier organizing this kind of an anti-general synod organization. Then in small f, there was also the Evangelical Lutheran Synod of the West, which was composed of the pro-general synod churches in Kentucky, Tennessee, and Indiana. So you see you have a sort of a polarity develop already here within by the third decade of the 19th century. And we'll go into the theology of this thing more in detail later on. Now, by the way, it's interesting that when Friedrich Winneken, W-Y-N-E-K-E-N, who was one of the real active missionaries, especially on the Indiana frontier, and later on became one of the participants in the organization of the Missouri Synod and was even its president for a while. He first was a member of this Synod of the West, and he had some experience with this, and he said that didn't quite satisfy him, and that's one of the reasons that he looked around for other affiliation later and helped organize the Missouri Synod. Well, these are only a few of the early synods that are organized, and you can see how the growth is from the Atlantic seaboard across the Appalachians into Tennessee, Kentucky, and Ohio, and Indiana, and before long, the wave of migration, you know, swept even further west. And before long, Americans were crossing the Mississippi River, and other immigrants were coming in, I'll take that up tonight, and filled up the Midwestern states there pretty well in a couple of decades. Now, Arabic too, we should pay some attention to that. The new church polity that is evident. And I have mentioned this concept of the ministerium before, but I want to be sure that it's clear and that you understand what is meant by that. Gradually, I said, then there were petitions by laymen and by congregations to be permitted to take part in the deliberations of these church conventions, and so there is a change evident during these decades then, which then develops into a lay clergy participation in these synods. Now, a word on the training of the clergy also. This, I pointed out last week, was one of the major problems of Lutherans in colonial America, that they didn't have enough well-trained pastors who could come and minister to them. And this is one of the reasons why the Swedish Lutherans, for example, when they began to use the English language gradually, they blended into the Anglican churches and they became Episcopalians. In New York, there were many crossovers like that too. And this was one of the real problems that Lutherans had to solve if they wanted to stay Lutheran. They had to have pastors to minister to their congregations. And it's significant that this took so long to organize a theological seminary in America. And this Hartwick Seminary, by the way, which I mention here, that is the first theological seminary for Lutherans in all of America, founded in 1815 in a little town in central New York State. And this was by bequest of a pastor who had worked there in central New York, also among the Indians in the latter part of the 18th century. And when he died, just a few years before the turn of the century, he left a will which specified that an enormous tract of land, which he had bought for practically nothing from the Indians, should be given as a foundation, as a bequest, to establish a seminary for the training of missionaries to either, quote, red or black heathens, he said. Red or black heathens. He was very much concerned with mission work, by the way. And it's an interesting thing that this Pastor Hartwick, even though he acquired such a huge tract of land, I forget how many acres there were, but it was an enormous extent, always had very good relationships with the Indians there, because he had a real personal compassion for the red men up there, and showed also a spiritual concern for them. By the way, later on, there is also a small Lutheran synod in New York State called after this Pastor Hartwig, which was not known for its shining example of adhering to confessional Lutheranism. It had a certain amount of freedom in its theology. Didn't get to be one of the real great synods, but it was not insignificant anyway. So 1815, this is the organization, establishment of the first Lutheran seminary for the training of pastors and missionaries that took these people, the Lutherans in America, an awfully long time to fill that need. And then, even at that, Hartwig Seminary didn't serve that broad an area. Before very long, though, Gettysburg Seminary was organized, was founded, and this was the first one that was established by a Lutheran synod. And its founding dates to 1826. That's now in the Lutheran Church in America, LCA, Gettysburg Seminary. By the way, you know what happened there during the Civil War, do you, in Gettysburg? Battle of Gettysburg, have you heard of that? I was really amazed. I had a lecture for a sizable gathering of churchmen a couple of days ago out of town, and on Lutheran history and so on. And a well-meaning lady came up to me afterwards, and she said she had learned so much in this bicentennial year about the influence of the Lutheran Church here in America. Why, she had heard in the lecture just the other day, she said, that when Lincoln made his Gettysburg Address, that was made on the campus of a Lutheran seminary. Wow, that was the seminary. But Lincoln made that address not because he was influenced or attracted by Lutheran theology, but because the Battle of Gettysburg happened to have been fought there. And so that didn't exactly sanctify the Gettysburg Address. So some interesting notions that occur once in a while. Well, let's turn to point B, the expansion of Lutheran population and Western population across the Western frontier. And as I said before, I could have taken this point B up first to show you what the movement of people was to the West, and then show you how different Lutheran synods were organized. But either way, basic here was crossing that mountain range, which you see also outlined in that more yellow section running southwest to northeast on the map. That was quite an epic, by the way, in the years before the turn of the century, when those settlers in the Carolinas and Virginia and other states decided to move westward. You know, one of the outstanding pioneers in that whole movement was Daniel Boone. Other people of similar inclination, they enjoyed finding their way through the trackless mountains and forests, you know, and they opened up the different passes that were necessary to accommodate the wagons and the people. And so as the population flowed westward, there were new states admitted to the Union, and I list a few of those. Kentucky, admitted as a state in 1792 already. It's quite early. And by 1800, Kentucky had 200,000 people. And then Tennessee was admitted as a state 1 year later in 1793. And also in Pennsylvania, by the way, now you look at the map, there, Pennsylvania is out beyond the reach of that demographic movement. It's to the north of that, and yet in Pennsylvania also there was a flow of people from the east to the west. And that's significant that in this year, 1797, the Pennsylvania Ministerium, which was centered in eastern Pennsylvania, of course, decided, though, that the center of gravity had shifted so far west that they were going to hold one convention in three in the western part of the state to redress this balance a little bit. Now then, there is also expansion into the Northwest Territory. Now, they had a border there that beyond which, in the years right after the American Revolution, was simply vaguely called the Northwest Territories. And that included roughly from about here and parts of Wisconsin even, and Illinois, Michigan was in there, before those territories, those areas were separated and later on given statehood. And here now the pioneers at the turn of the century were pushing on into that vast country for various reasons. Some hoped to get cheap land, some trappers, traders, and what have you. And so with this flow of population westward and northwestward, there was soon an enormous challenge for missionaries to work among those people. Ohio then became a state in 1803, and as I mentioned before, the Ohio Synod there was organized. By 1814, Lutheran pastors there reported that they already had 60 congregations and 37 church buildings. So you can see that soon after the turn of the century, there was a fair representation of Lutherans. By 1817, Lutherans were migrating into Indiana and even beyond the Mississippi River. Now, point three, by the way, is also quite important now. These migrations were all on horseback or with wagon or on foot. Daniel Boone usually walked on foot. And there is a significant breakthrough, though, just about this time. Now, one of these things is the opening of the Erie Canal in 1825. And that is significant for the opening of the whole Great Lakes Basin. Still got our trouble with this map. Doesn't pull down far enough. But if you look at this vast land area here, if people would have to walk from Pennsylvania to Chicago, this would be quite a journey on foot or by wagon. But now the way they went was up the Hudson River here, and then just from up here, a little beyond where you can see on the map, a canal was built connecting the upper Hudson with the Great Lakes. By the way, a railroad was put through there too very soon. And once this Erie Canal was built, you know, barge or boat transportation is very cheap. Very cheap. They pulled boats along the Erie Canal by donkeys or horses. And sometimes they used sails too, but it was much more reliable to have draft animals pull them. And there are many, many accounts of people migrating westward by this route. They would get very cheap passage. They could sit for a nominal fee on top of the freight on the deck of a barge. Now, if it rained or snowed, that was not very comfortable. But many of the people who were determined to go westward to get their own land and be able to build their own house and do their own work, you know, they were really determined. And so they endured many a hardship when they traveled like that. And among some of the early immigrants, by the way, right after the railway was opened there, that ran parallel with the Erie Canal. Sometimes it was a toss-up whether they should ride the train, which was considered much more classy because it had a covered car, you know, or sit on the deck of a houseboat, and the trains made better speed. They went all of 15 miles an hour. But I remember reading about one group of immigrants. They had a real hefty discussion, you know, take the canal or the train. And the people, there were so many progressives among them, that the train went out, and they got on the train, and there was an accident on the train. And they said, woe is us, because God's judgment is upon us, because we tried out one of these newfangled inventions, you see. And you know what would happen on those trains, even in the 1830s, they had some rails like this. They were made out of planks, wood. And there was a strip of a band iron was tacked on top of this. And when those, they weren't really nails. They were not much more than neats or cleats that held those things down, wore off or tore loose. There were cases where these strips would suddenly pop up on one end and ram right through the floor of the car. And if you sat right there and weren't impaled on it, ready for barbecue, you know, it was very fortunate. So accidents like that did occur, and that must have been a very hazardous kind of enterprise to travel that far in that primitive country. But anyway, what the significant part of the opening of that Erie Canal is that people living in New York and others that came from Europe, when they wanted to get into the interior of the United States, you see, then they would come down the Great Lakes route, and here's where Detroit is, come past Detroit, and on the, St. Clair River there, I guess, and go up and come down this way through those straits up there, which you can't see on this map, and then they could go as far as Lake Michigan and get all the way down to Chicago or Milwaukee by boat, which was not all that cheap. The Great Lakes boats were fairly expensive as far as fare went, because sailboats were somewhat hazardous, the narrow passages that they had to negotiate. And so the steamships were much more reliable and safer, but they cost more money. But this is how, then before very long, a huge migration flooded into the central states. And this, of course, gave the Lutheran missionaries an enormous challenge, which we will be following in its few highlights before long. One other point that I thought would be good to mention here as far as the expansion of population is concerned is government Indian policy. And I just have one little fact listed here, that during Andrew Jackson's presidency, which extended from 1829 to 1837, there were 94 Indian treaties established with different peoples and different tribes. So there was an enormous activity as far as government concern with Indians was concerned. And not all of this was all that kindly, by the way. The Indians usually caught the dirty end of the stick. One of the saddest of all experiences was that fully culminated even after Andrew Jackson's time. But we're usually, because we live in central part here, we're usually concerned with these Indians living in the tier of states from Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, maybe. But here in the southeastern states, by the way, including Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi, and so there had been some Indian tribes that were very populous and were very progressive, like the Cherokees and the Seminoles. The Seminoles may have been a little different, but the Cherokees and the Choctaws and tribes like that very nimbly responded to the coming of the white man. And in fact, some, like the Cherokee tribe, were downright anxious to learn new things and new ways of life. And they had settled down in these states, Georgia, Alabama, and when the white population increased in density, this reflected very badly for the Indians. And finally, there were some real tussles there, and the Indians were dislodged from their territories and driven out. And finally, they ended up in Oklahoma. And when they got that wasteland in Oklahoma, then nobody guessed that it would make good farmland if it was irrigated, and nobody guessed that there was oil underneath that good farmland. So sometimes the Indians had the last laugh, but it sure made for a lot of moves they had to make and a lot of unhappiness. And this, by the way, government policy, which was sometimes also initiated by churches, especially churches like the Methodists, they believed that you should do this large-scale engineering for these unlettered Indians. Move them together, and if things don't work out here, set aside a big reservation over there, put them in there and organize schools and tell them how they should conduct their lives. That made mission work very difficult. You know, the Indians were demoralized because they were constantly being uprooted, constantly being badgered as to what they should do and so on. So I would say that the middle decades of the 19th century were a real sad one for the red men in America. Well, now we have to say something about page 2 here, too. If you turn this over, you will see that my Roman 2 topic is adaptation of Lutheranism to the American environment. First, I'd like to say something about the relationship of Lutherans to other Protestants. There was, of course, a pretty close bond among German Lutherans with German Reformed and German Moravians because of the language and culture affinity. But gradually, as it became clear that confessional Lutheranism, that is, adherence, careful adherence to the precepts of the Bible as they were interpreted and defined in the Lutheran confessions from the time of the Reformation, that this was something special. And gradually there was a separation in some places, although it took a long time in other places between, say, Lutherans and Reformed, who were both German. There were some other problems, like Arabic too. Here, this John Christopher Kunze, who was the son-in-law of Henry Muhlenberg, whom I mentioned already, and who was the founder of the New York Ministerium in 1792, he analyzed the Lutheran-Reform tensions in history, and then he concluded this way. He said, "The time is over when Protestant parties could exclude each other for the sake of unessential dissensions." In other words, he thought that the distinctions in doctrine between the Lutherans and the Reformed were not all that important. And then Arabic 3, Lutherans and Episcopalians, and here I quote this Kunze once more. He said, "The 39 articles," by the way, that's one of the chief confessions of the Anglican Church, which they had drawn up. "The 39 articles fully agree with the Augsburg Confession, and every Lutheran can subscribe to them." Well, now it happened that the 39 articles were Christian, but they were Calvinistic. And Kunze advocating, though, that the Lutherans could subscribe to them, that sort of confused the difference between Lutherans and Calvinists also. And third line from the bottom in this paragraph, in the New York Ministerium, Kunze advocated that English-speaking Lutherans were to join the Episcopalian Church rather than have them form a new English Lutheran congregation. So you can see, even, say, in 1800, there was a tendency for Lutherans to be lost to the other Protestant churches whenever the language transition was being made, you see. Now, number 4, Lutherans and Methodists. There, the relationship was not quite as friendly, not among the German Lutherans, because the Lutherans always had a dread for this Methodist emphasis on feeling. You know, the Methodists got too loud in the services, yelling and shouting and things like this, and the Lutherans didn't take to that too well. And Lutherans and Baptists, there was a real problem there too, since the Baptists had such an adamant resistance against the sacrament of baptism for children and infants. And since the Baptists denied that baptism really worked regeneration, therefore Lutherans and Baptists didn't get along too well. Although I'm not speaking for all the Lutherans, there were Swedish Lutherans, by the way, who settled in Illinois and in Wisconsin and then in Iowa and Minnesota later on. And the Swedish Lutherans had a peculiar affinity or inclination to be won over to other churches. Swedes were probably the easiest of all the Lutherans to switch church affiliation. There were even some Swedes who became Mormons. No problem. They just switched like that, you know. They'd not rather fight than switch. They'd rather switch than fight any day. So what I have outlined here doesn't just all hold for all types of Lutherans. Norwegians were somewhat easy to convert, but there were a good many Norwegian Lutherans who knew pretty well what it was all about, and they stayed Lutheran at any cost. Well, now, capital B, the internal theological adaptation of Lutherans in America, this was another problem. Now, we have to go back and look at the organization of the General Synod in 1820. I mentioned this was the first federation of Lutheran synods, like the Pennsylvania Ministerium, the New York Ministerium, and some others. They formed a federation. Now, the opposite of a federation is an amalgamation, when synods join so that they lose their individual identity. Now, this was a federation. Each synod kept its own structure, but they had a federated relationship there. And in this general synod, there was prevalent a theology which was not just real confessional. They had problems with church polity and church authority, and problems of theology and also of the confessions. And one of the outstanding leaders in this tendency, let's call it liberal Lutheranism, which is really what it was this man Samuel Simon Schmucker, who lived in the years 1799 to 1873. He became the avant-garde for a tendency in theology in the General Synod. And he was president of the Pennsylvania Ministerium for a while. And here is something that one of his contemporaries stated: Dr. Schmucker was the severest moralist I ever knew. He did not know one card from another, so that meant he didn't indulge in anything like card playing. He knew nothing of checkers or backgammon or chess. He never was in a theater or circus, never heard an opera. He even doubted the propriety of Christians going to hear famous vocalists in a concert hall, especially if they had appeared on the operatic stage. So he was a very abstemious individual, like a Methodist almost, you know, like a Puritan, but his theology was pretty flexible. And that's a sort of a strange combination, but it happens more often than one would think. Another Eastern Lutheran who became almost notorious for this kind of liberal theology was Frederick Henry Quitman. He was the second president of the New York Ministerium, was also a graduate of Halle University, that very good university in Prussian territory, from which Muhlenberg also had come earlier. He arrived in America in 1795, so this is after the Revolution. And he'd been charged with all kinds of things, Unitarianism and rationalism, but he was an adherent of the school of biblical supranaturalism. That is, he didn't rule out all the possibility for God and the angels and their existence. You see, he said, yeah, I believe that there is the area of the supernatural, but that doesn't always safeguard the complete system of theology. He had a hybrid theology. He mixed all kinds of elements together. And actually, he tried to fight deism. Remember, I explained that last time. Sort of a form of rationalism. He tried to fight it with its own rationalistic weapons, and that's what backfired on him. Quitman wrote a revised catechism, by the way, in which he watered down Lutheran doctrine. And he tried to sell that. He had some difficulty. Not every Lutheran bought that. But he made quite an impression, however. And he was a thorn in the flesh for a lot of concerned and conservative Lutherans. In fact, if you ask conservative pastors now about Quitman, they all know who that was. And he's the black sheep in that camp. He's the star witness in the camp of the liberal Lutherans. And then Arabic IV, what this school of theology, which was not very Lutheran, but only somewhat so, what this was called was American Lutheranism. And it was formulated in a document which is called the Definite Synodical Platform. The chief author of that was this man, S.S. Schmucker. And this topic now is new Lutheran infusions in the mid-19th century. This means that there were new Lutherans from Germany and from other European countries who came to America and added a new dimension here. So my first topic is the reasons for renewed Lutheran emigrations from Europe. And capital A, I just want to give you just an introductory notion of what these reasons were. We cannot exhaustively treat that in just a half hour that we have left. But there were political changes in Europe in the early 19th century which really upset the conditions in Germany, which made people uneasy. It uprooted some, and whatever other negative results there were. And the first subpart there I call the impact of the French Revolution. And then, secondly, is the restructuring of Germany after Waterloo. That's when Napoleon was defeated. Now, if you look at this map of Germany, by the way, you see the... Now, this is a little early, you see, that's at the time of the Reformation. But basically, the divisions in Germany, although they changed somewhat, they fluctuated somewhat, but they remained pretty much the same down to the French Revolution. And there were several hundred different provinces and duchies and kingdoms. A few were even kingdoms under the German Empire. Now, when we talk about the German Empire in 1800, by the way, I don't mean the North German Empire, which Bismarck put together in 1866. That's a different one. Now we're talking about the Habsburg Empire. Here, this map doesn't go quite far enough. You look at this map here in Austria, that was the home territory, the family inheritance of land from feudal times of the Habsburg house. And they became emperors of this whole empire that was called the Holy Roman Empire or the German Empire. And that received some pretty severe jolts, by the way, through history. But it continued till Napoleon took over in France, and the French thought, my, here we have such a marvelous new insight into what the importance of liberty and fraternity and equality means, and we should share that with those poor, unfortunate Germans who are still living in such abysmal, feudal conditions. And the Germans agreed, that's right. Why don't you come over and help us? The German people. Now, the rulers didn't have that kind of notion, you see. But the German people thought this would be a good idea, have the French share their insights. By the way, this is French messianism, the historians call it. They thought they had the ideology to free the world and save it. It was a secular form of salvation. But when the French armies were marching all over Germany, by the way, the Germans quickly changed their minds because they found those French military boots had some awfully heavy heels. And so there was an enormous reaction that boiled over in Germany that runs for a century, by the way. And one of the things, though, that Napoleon had done right away when he conquered Germany, that's a good number of years before he was finally defeated, was to rearrange the boundaries of these German provinces and territories and regroup them and establish, simply by law, he simply issued a promulgation, I'm going to establish a new kingdom here, you know, with these territories. And so they boiled it down to about 30. So they reduced the number at about 8 or 10-fold, by the way. So what happened in Germany, now Brandenburg, by the way, that was one of the most important northern territories, which had already been expanding all the way into this Prussia doesn't show here. But if you look here, this was East Prussia right there. And the electors of Brandenburg took over those territories and they became kings already by 1700, or a little after. Prussia was one of the most important anchors against the French. Then you have Saxony here. Between Brandenburg and Austria, Saxony was being squeezed all through history. That was Luther's homeland. Some of the finest German culture, by the way, in central Germany there in Saxony. But they were being squeezed by Prussia on the north and Austria in the south. And what the Saxon government didn't figure out correctly is that the French could be defeated. But the Saxons were some of the most zealous allies of the French in the war. And when Napoleon went down, bingo, there went the chances for future of Saxony down to near zero. And they sliced off a big chunk of territory here that was given to Brandenburg, and there about two-fifths of Saxony was given over to Brandenburg, and there were a lot of Saxons that were very, very unhappy in the 19th century. Because they thought the Prussians were some of, you know, Germans didn't have a real well-knit national feeling so early. And the Saxons thought the Prussians were stupid boors from the north. And they resented the idea that the Prussian king ruled there. And by the way, this territory here, you see this little strip sticking out here? That is Silesia. It doesn't show up well on this map here, but it's about in... let's see, in about here, this territory here. Silesia had been taken over by the Prussians in a war earlier than that, and the Silesians thought the Prussians were real boors from the north. They resented that, and so there were, with the regrouping of the political boundaries of Germany, lots of resentments all the way around. And that was one of the factors, by the way. Also, the reaction against the French Revolution, this upheaval, the military invasion that made life in many areas of Germany quite difficult. And then also the socio-economic factors, by the way. Germany had been so lambasted by the war. They had bled so much that economically, Germany was really flat. And at that time, the industrialization process began, and that dislodged a lot of people. had different effect in different areas. Like in North Germany, here in Northeast Germany, one of the results was that the large landholders got more and more territory. What the result was in Saxony here was generally that there was industrialization introduced and the people lost their jobs. And some of them tried to make their living in cottage industries, you know, taking contract spinning or weaving. And then when they had the job done, the entrepreneur, the businessman, who had enough money to invest in flax or wool. In Saxony, there was a big flax industry by the linen industry. Some of the finest linen in the world was made there. And what they would do is take the flax fibers and farm it out to homes, and they'd process it. And when factory system came in, those people were out of luck because you could do it cheaper in a factory, you see. Other factors which helped to undermine German economics was that when cotton production began to flourish in other parts of the world, the cotton industry undercut the Saxon flax industry, the linen industry, and that helped also. And there was very difficult going for a lot of people. So many of them were interested in moving out if they could possibly do so. Another point that I mentioned there is introduction of new crops results in sharp increase of population. So when they introduced potatoes into Germany, by the way, well before that, the population boomed because you can feed more people on potatoes than you can on rye, you know, on 1 acre of land. And so when the war erupted and all these negative results ensued, with an increased population, the problem is always worse. So that made it much more difficult. And so reaction to the continental system and economic dislocations, that's basically, the continental system was what Napoleon tried to impose on all of Europe, to permit no trade with any countries in Europe, especially to cut England out, you see. And so they were isolated during the war. And then when Napoleon was defeated, the isolation is removed, and then they were subject to English commerce and so on. Bad situation. And then, above all, though, capital C, the religious factors in the history of the Germanies. And one important thing is rationalism, which had eroded the theology of the German churches and German theologians. Now, when you read the history of these immigrants, by the way, the one thing that they will always emphasize first is this rationalism. Many of the immigrants, when you read their own accounts, why they left Germany, often don't say anything about the bad economic or political situations, but they focus on the rationalism in the churches. Say, we couldn't stand that anymore. And it was really bad. And I cite this one pastor, L.F.E. Krause, and his description of the inroads of rationalism. This pastor Krause was a pioneer in Midwestern states, by the way. He was the first Lutheran pastor to work in Wisconsin, and later on worked in some other areas too. And he left behind a lengthy description of what happened in Germany. And his chief criticism is directed against rationalism, that it corroded the churches, caused even pastors to abandon the doctrines of the Bible, he says, and so on. So that's what I mean. That's one example of a person from Germany who wrote about this. And then another one, C. Bixel, by the way, and I give you the title of his book, if you can read German. I'm sure Mrs. Streisel can, right? Yeah. This book is very interesting, by the way. You can borrow it here on the campus. Remembrances or memoirs from the life of a country parson and Landgeistlichen, that's a rural pastor. And he describes the degradation of the ministry in the German Lutheran churches, how they argued about the small things. One thing, for example, congregations were supposed to give pastors some eggs at certain occasions. I forget how many times a year. And the pastors argued whether there was supposed to be 15 or 16 eggs. That was the main discussion at one pastoral conference, he says, that he attended. And he has many, many descriptions of the poor sermons that pastors preached. They didn't believe in the spiritual truths of the Bible anymore, so they had to find some kind of literary or practical meaning, you know. Like at Christmas time, Bixell says, there was one pastor who preached a sermon on the Christ child in the manger, and he said the whole emphasis in the sermon was that it was better for animals to stall feed them than to drive them out in the pasture in wintertime. That's all he could get out of that text, you see. The spiritual meaning was all gone. And this Bixell's book, by the way, I read that many years ago, very interesting. Now, unfortunately, written in German, but it is very descriptive. Then I'd like to read you this under C, an American description of the theology of German rationalism. One American pastor said, in Germany, churches have become measurably corrupt through false teachers creeping into the church. These teachers impiously deny all the fundamental doctrines of our salvation, which is in Jesus Christ. The Germans who have come to this country in late years have imbibed these false principles. So I give you the reference here. This Reverend John Ernest Bergman, a Lutheran pastor in 1804, made this statement. And I give you the book where you can find it, too, The Lutherans in North America, page 105. And then, besides, there were philosophical ingredients of German rationalism, by the way. If you haven't ever studied history or philosophy, maybe some of these names are strange to you, and don't worry, don't lose any sleep on that if they are. But Immanuel Kant was a famous German philosopher, died in 1804, so right during the French War, you know. And he had some very profound books that he wrote on philosophy, but one of the most urgent questions that he tried to answer was this question, whether you can really be sure that there is a reality in that spiritual dimension, you know, the whole question of the existence of God and so on. And he tried to bring this down to a manageable dimension for human beings. He said, well, there are two areas where the human mind functions, and in that area up there, he says, we never can know anything anyway, so don't worry about it. That's about the, I'm simplifying it a little bit, you know, but that's about what he said. And then concern yourself with the question of practical morality and practical ethics, and that will indicate then that you are not a bad Christian. So he tried to popularize this thing and reduce it to a simpler dimension. And in doing this, he set up a skepticism, that is, a question mark, you know, saying, we can't really know anything about that dimension anyway, can we? And the answer always is no, if you want to answer it. See, this is what we mean by skepticism in the religious, in the theological dimension. That's one negative contribution. So later on, by the way, the Kantianism infects all theology after that. And then another German philosopher was Friedrich Hegel, who, strangely enough, also was a Lutheran and wanted to remain a Lutheran, and he tried to grapple with the problems that they had at that time, but he died much later, 1831. And he tried to make a good case for the existence of God. But when he got all his system put together, he came up with this idea of constant change in history, the process of what he called the dialectic. if you've never heard about it, don't lose any sleep over it. But that means this tension between two almost opposite points. And this is the process through which always a new kind of a level of progression is achieved in human society, he said. Now, that was very tricky business for theologians afterwards, because that gave them the rationale for claiming that we got to find new and better ways to express those old doctrines. You see, the old notions have to be rejected. They're outmoded, and we have to always address ourselves to the new. That was very detrimental, by the way, to theological studies. Number three, the input of Romanticism. Romanticism is an emotional emphasis in literature and in art in Germany. And there were some very prominent Lutheran pastors who were involved in this, by the way. Think of Gottfried Herder, H-E-R-D-E-R. Certainly many Americans have heard about Herder because he was a great poet. He was also a Lutheran pastor, and he was one of the real avant-garde people in this Romanticist movement. They emphasized feeling rather than knowledge in the head and facts and reason and so on. So when you apply only emotion to a very difficult situation, as you had right after the French Revolution, you know, it becomes very subjective. You only ask not what are the facts, you only ask how do I feel about this. By the way, today we are in a real Romanticist period. That's one of the problems. You have a question, sir?
The word existentialism, is that related to this?
It develops later on, yes. In the time of Herder, Herder lived only a few years into the 19th century. So at that time, existentialism was not yet used, but it is related to Romanticism because both are extremely subjective. It's the I, myself, that is in the center of the whole thing. In the Romantics, it is what I feel. And in the existentialists, it's my existence is the most important thing. Yeah, so the two are related.
And is that relating to Pentecostalism today to a degree?
Well, the two are separate, yes, but the emotional part is related. Yes, the whole atmosphere today is dominated by a subjectivism. And one scholar who writes on these things, you know, intellectual history, Jacques Barzun at Columbia University. He calls our age the neo-Romanticist age. And neo-Pentecostalism and the charismatic movement and so on, they could not run as vigorously as they do if it weren't for this subjectivism and neo-Romanticism. Now, when you have Romanticism plus nationalism, which was the German reaction against the French Revolution, that makes for extreme secularization. That is, they took all the emphasis away from God and put it all down here on people, the nation, our feelings, our achievements, and so on. So that's a long story, by the way, in some of my classes here when I teach the history of the church in the 19th century. Then I can go into more detail in this, but I wouldn't want to detain you till after midnight or so. But this is the key point here, by the way. It's Romanticism plus nationalism. That's a bad mix. So there were distortions of biblical theology and terminology. By the way, the Germans at that time, when they talked about the people of God, as you have that expression in the Bible, they considered themselves to be the only real people of God because, after all, they fought the French, didn't they? When they spoke about the shedding of blood, like in the Passion story, they said, whose blood was really shed for the salvation of the people? It was the blood of the German martyrs, they said. And this is what actually pastors would preach in the pulpit. So they when you hear this word secularization, you see, they really brought it down to only the human dimension. So it's no wonder that there were reactions against this, and they said, hey, you forgot the Bible. You forgot the spiritual emphasis, that Christ died for us, and so on. And so there were many debasements of the doctrine of the church. And small c there, this is one thing I did want to put in here. If you don't know German, that word means the debasement, Herabwürdigung, debasement. And that's what one German writer called it. Through all this process, there was gradually a greater and greater debasement of the prestige and the respect for the ministry. And so it wasn't only that the Bible was disparaged, but the ministry was considered defunct class, you know, that had outlived its purpose. And a lot of people had only contempt for pastors. That also was a bad development. So, number five, then, the Prussian Union in 1817. I already referred to that. That's the development that the Prussian king ordered the Reformed churches and the Lutheran churches in his domain to unite. And one of the most irritating areas where this frustrated the Lutherans especially, you know, the Reformed don't believe in the real presence and the Lord's Supper, and the Lutherans do, and so they worked out a formula for the distribution of the Lord's Supper, and one of the king's courtiers wrote that up, by the way, and this formula read, the Lord Jesus Christ says, : this is my body, this is my blood. And the Lutherans knew full well that that should make it possible for both Reformed and Lutherans to use. And the Lutherans insisted, this is the true body of the Lord Jesus Christ. Take, eat, this is the, like we use it today. And the Reformed wouldn't use that one, you see. So the king had to negotiate, and the Lutherans bought. They wouldn't use it. And then the king ordered churches all over the realm to use that new agenda with that rubric in it, and the Lutherans still bought. So some people refused to go to church. And by the way, that was a state church system, not only in Prussia, but in other provinces. The other provinces, except Saxony, didn't have that kind of a law, by the way. They didn't have many reformed. The king of Saxony had about 100 years before that become Catholic, and most of his members were Lutheran, but there weren't many reformed. So that problem of the union didn't exist in Saxony, but most other provinces had it too. And then the rulers got pretty hard-nosed about it when people refused to go to church if they met in a private home and read a sermon. They broke a law because according to the state church they were supposed to go to an assigned church and worship in no other place. It was a pretty rigid system, and some cases where people decided, I'm going to have reading service, I'll invite the Joneses and the Smiths over, you know, and the police came in and said, you have an illegal assembly. And so they take people to jail, and that didn't sit so well with a lot of people. And when they could, they left Germany as soon as they could get out, you know. Yes, Mr.
Wasn't the question at the Evangelische Kirche Catechism very much like the Lutheran Catechism?
It has a lot of similarities, yes, but...
I know my grandmother didn't speak of it.
Yes.
And I didn't see any difference. Of course, it was German, naturally.
Oh, yeah. On the doctrine of the Lord's Supper, there was some difference. And then, of course, in a few places, the double predestination notion of the Calvinists came through. But I will say that there were... Now, the evangelicals, that's what they called those reformed, or the union. see, they didn't like the word Lutheran anymore, so they would call themselves evangelicals. There were many good Christians and also some very zealous missionaries in that group, but they had a very low level of Lutheran consciousness. And the distinctive doctrines, where the Lutherans obviously stood much closer on the scriptures than the Calvinists, that was very indistinct. And some of the evangelicals were pretty four square on the Bible, even though they didn't care much to be identified as Lutherans. You know, they said, we're Christians. That's good enough. So, yeah, I know in Wisconsin there were some evangelicals that did very good work. And by the way, Eden Seminary was their early school founded down here, you know. And in the old days, Eden Seminary put out some fairly serious-minded pastors, and not incompetent either. I know they learned some fairly good theology and were able to preach well. They did serious work, and I saw some of their congregations in Wisconsin. Serious-minded people. But low consciousness on the distinctive doctrine of the Lutherans, like the real presence in the Lord's Supper, predestination, only one kind for salvation, not damnation, and so on. Yeah, this distinction, though, that was a major problem among Protestant churches on the American frontier. Many clashes resulted, by the way. And one thing, by the way, that I didn't really go into before, I just wanted to make some time, but one thing, I touched on it when I mentioned the earlier Eastern Lutherans, that they didn't want, say, exorcism. They thought that was Roman Catholic superstition. And many other things, by the way, they didn't want any vestments for their pastors. And the evangelicals usually were that way too. They were very strongly anti-Roman Catholic. So they were, in some places, they were first anti-Roman Catholic, and then they were evangelical Protestant Christians. And I know, I read records of congregations, for example, that split because the Lutherans said chanting is a good liturgical custom. And the evangelicals said, that's Catholic. You will be damned if you'll actually go to hell if you indulge in those medieval superstitious practices. So there were many tensions, by the way, on the liturgical dimension, where the Lutherans were much more tolerant in a way, and the evangelicals were rather uptight on those things. And some Lutherans, like in the Eastern Synods, they were uptight too on liturgics. Okay, we've got to move along though. So number two, Roman two, we should take this up yet. The main channels of German religious immigration in mid-19th century, there were some who left for Australia under a Pastor Kovel. And by the way, there's a German historian by the name of Iwan, Iwan. And I wanted to put his name down so you wouldn't have to write it in and you wouldn't forget it or lose it. He wrote a number of books on these German immigrants, and if you can read German, unfortunately it's not been translated into English, but they're very interesting and scholarly. He relates some of these. Also, one immigration movement that came to North America, he has written up in two interesting volumes. And the interesting thing, by the way, about this German historian is he published his books, the latest ones, by the early 1940s. That's when the war against Russia already was in swing. And when the Russians defeated Hitler and drove back into Germany, all the libraries and the archives where Ivan got his material were all destroyed. And the materials which he used are gone. So for that reason, Ivan especially is a precious historian, because he got this stuff researched just before it disappeared. Now, the Prussian and Silesian immigrations to America That's the one that Ivan wrote up, by the way. That's one of the most important sources for that immigration. There was a pastor by the name of J.A.A. Grabau who led a large number of Lutherans to New York. They landed there, went up the Hudson River, and then across the Erie Canal, like I outlined before, and down the Great Lakes, and Grabau and a large part of his congregation stayed in Buffalo, New York. And that's where this group afterwards gets the name the Buffalo Synod. But some of these immigrants went on through the Great Lakes and landed in Milwaukee. And they founded the first Lutheran congregation in Wisconsin. And this man, L.F.E. Krause, whom I mentioned before, is the first Lutheran pastor there. Then C, there was the Saxon immigration to Missouri, 1838 and 39. And by the way, this is described in a very thorough book by Walter O. Forster. The title of the book is Zion on the Mississippi. Who's heard of this book? Let me see the hands. A few. There's a tremendous amount of information there. These are the founding fathers of the Missouri Synod later on. Walther and others are in this Saxon immigration group. And then thirdly, there were the Leahy immigrations. And do you know any of the places that they founded? Do you know those places in Michigan called Frankenmuth, Frankentrost, Frankenhof, and so on? You know them. Good. They are really outstanding Lutheran congregations, by the way. And Leahy was a churchman in Bavaria. He had heard about the tremendous need of Lutheran immigrants and also American Indians. And he was only a parish pastor, but he began to spread the word around. Any young men would like to go to America to become missionaries? He says, I'll give you some training, and then you can go over there and get some more training and work. And he recruited scores of missionaries and sent them over here. Many of them helped organize the Missouri Synod in 1847. And one of the interesting approaches that he used was sending a colony. The first colony he sent, by the way, was under August Cramer. Cramer, C-R-A-E-M-E-R, was a pastor. And they sent a little colony and told them to find a place in the Saginaw Valley and establish a village and then use that as a base from which they could do mission work among the Indians. That was the purpose. Now, maybe someplace along the line, I got a chance to tell you a little bit about the work among the Indians there, huh? That is a very interesting chapter. But for tonight, I think our time is up. A question yet?
Can the book, Zion on the Mississippi, still be printed at the...
That, unfortunately, is out of print. If you can ever dig up any copy secondhand, grab it, or tell us about it. There are always students who would like to buy it. So if you ever see copies of that, please let us know. Yes?
This Krause that's mentioned here, that's not the Krause-Lebensfelder.
No.
Former professor.
He didn't have he spelled his name K-R-A-U-S-Z.
Double, yeah.
Yeah, S-Z or S-S. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, this is a different man. Okay, good to see you all and so interested in history. And see you back next Thursday, right?
Thank you.